You're listening to the British Muslim Girl Diaries with Zara and Amar. What would you do if you were diagnosed with a blood disorder tomorrow and needed to find someone to donate healthy cells to you through a stem cell transplant to stay alive? Keep in mind that new and healthy cells for a transplant have to almost be a complete match to your own cells. You would think you could turn to your family. They must be a complete match, right? But what if they're not? Neither are your friends. What now? Where would you turn next? Maybe join a donor transplant list like the Anthony Nolan Register if you're in the UK. Well, if you're from an ethnic minority background, it's even harder to find a match because so few of us have registered to join. Today we have guest Annie Hussein with us. Annie's from a British Asian background, and at the age of 17, she found out she had aplastic anemia, which is a condition where your bone marrow doesn't make enough blood cells. She was told that she needed a stem cell transplant to survive. However, it was difficult to find a match, and there was no one on the transplant register for her. In this episode, we find out about her fight to find a match. Welcome, Annie. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So just to find out a little bit more about you, you know, where in the UK are you based?
I'm currently sheltering from this unbearable heat, because I'm an absolute baby, in very posh Notting Hill in London. I've got cheap rent, don't worry. So yeah, with my beautiful window open.
Nice. Yeah, it's a nice area though to be living in.
Very lucky.
And then, yeah, where did you grow up?
It's a bit of both, but hopefully you can't hear it in my accent. So I grew up in Chelmsford in Essex, but then moved to Birmingham when I was about 10 or 11, so at the start of secondary school. So hopefully the accents have neutralised, but yeah, my family home and all my family are in Birmingham.
Ooh, yeah, no, I couldn't tell.
Oh, well, that's a relief.
Yeah, to me you sound like a Londoner, so maybe that's what the fusion gets you.
Well, it's just the Essex is bad and the Brummie's bad, so both of them together it's like, whoa.
Yeah, no, it has neutralised for sure, which is nice. But that's the huge, like, kind of like culture shock, I guess, between all these different areas, right? They're so different.
Yeah, and then I went to study in York and like the north of England. I don't know, where are you guys from?
London, pretty much.
London, yeah. Doesn't get more interesting than that.
I haven't travelled. We used to travel like actually every year when I was younger to Birmingham for like a 2-day trip because my parents, so exotic, but my parents had just family friends there, so we'd go visit them. But the food was always so good, so for us it was pretty good.
Brown Town and the Balti Triangle are real things, so there we go.
I mentioned in the intro, so, you know, you were diagnosed with aplastic anemia at a really young age, 17. So what was the process around that? Like, what were you experiencing symptoms?
Yeah, so because I was 17, it's such a difficult age because I was like in the throes of like A-level college. So I was like going out with friends all the time, like doing so much stuff, you know, going shopping, like going to college, going home and like quickly getting the bus, going to town, doing shopping, coming home, cooking, doing work, like constantly just like so busy, going to see neighbours, going to see friends, going to parties. And then all of a sudden I started getting these horrible headaches. And I'm not someone who really like suffers from migraines or ever had at this point. So I started to just spend, you know, if you have a really bad headache, people say just take a paracetamol and go to sleep. But that taking a paracetamol and go to sleep ended up being like months of just like having to go to sleep all the time. I was taking cocodamol like 5 times a day. I was going to sleep and just feeling so tired all the time. Like I would go to sleep at like, let's say, 8 o'clock in the evening, and then I wouldn't wake up until like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would wake up and I'd go to brush my teeth and I'd be falling asleep on the like toilet seat brushing my teeth. Do you know when you literally like your body just feels so tired and exhausted? And I'm a brown girl, right? So I've got a lot of color to my skin. All my friends were noticing how pale I was, like to the point that, you know, when people just look a bit yellow and you know the insides of your eyes, they're quite like pinkish. Mine were like ghost white. And, you know, the palms of your hands, they're a bit pinky, and then you press them and they go a bit white. When you press mine, like no colour would return to them. But I think the thing that really made me say, okay, why I need to do something about this, was I remember like walking, and I was somebody who used to like walk all the time. I'd get 2 buses to go to school, to go to college. Like I was not an unhealthy person, not very sporty, but I was constantly active. And I couldn't even walk to the bus stop. And I, you know how it is, you make ideas up and you come up with your own solutions in your own head. So I was like, oh, it's because I've been sleeping so much. I'm just really unfit. I just need to learn how to walk again. Which is obviously a load of rubbish, because after someone spends like a month in bed, they don't forget how to walk down the stairs. But I was defeated from like, I'd walk up four stairs and I'd have to sit down and I could feel my heart pumping in my chest. And you know when you're running for the bus and you just sprint and you don't realise how much energy that takes? It was like that, but for like the smallest tasks. So I'd literally like walk five steps and I would just be like, oh my God, my whole body is just weak. And I am not very good with needles or blood or anything. So I just basically put off talking to anyone or seeing anyone. And I also had a few bruises, but I didn't really think much of it because a bruise is a bruise, right? You just don't think anything. And I made very clear that I was not going to Google any symptoms because I knew that was going to tell me I was dying, which lo and behold, I actually was. So this was a Friday at, I actually think it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He said, if there's anything to worry about, we'll contact you in the next week, probably next Wednesday. If there's nothing to worry about, you won't even get a phone call. That night, I had some naan. I remember eating it. It was naan and Nutella, because my favourite thing in the world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. It's a hybrid, you know. We've got leftover. It's bread. Bread and Nutella. What on earth is not to love? And I remember chewing just a bit and my jaw was tired. And I was like, wow. Like, I had it with my muscles being tired on my legs, but like, I couldn't even chew food properly. I was that tired and I fell asleep at like 7 o'clock that night. And there was a knock at the door at 3 o'clock in the morning and my mum came into my room and she had tears in her eyes and she was like, the doctor's here, you need to go to hospital. And I was like still half asleep, you know, I was just confused. And yeah, so a doctor had showed up at our house and was like worried and was like, you need to go to hospital now because something's really serious. And my parents were like, are you sure? And they were like, we just need to make sure that like the blood results are as bad as we think they are. And I knew instantly, I was like, yeah, they are. And I was kind of relieved there was an answer for why I was feeling so crap for so long. You know, when you're like, I'm feeling rubbish, but there's no solution. This was finally, like, I'm not making it up in my head. Like, it's not just me being like a terrible teenager, being like a bit moody or grumpy because I'm tired because of work. There is a reason why I'm feeling like this. So the next day, my dad rushed me to hospital 4 o'clock in the morning, sat there, was moved to a separate room away from everybody. Doctors were like giving me scans and there were mentions of the word leukemia around and I didn't really know what that was. And I was just a bit confused. And then the doctor, the consultant sat down next to me and was asking me about my family and what I was doing at college and work. And me just being naive, I was like, oh, she's just a nice doctor. And it was obvious then that she was asking me because I was in a very serious situation. So she told me that I had a rare type of blood cancer and that we needed to move things on as quick as possible. So yeah, the next day I was wheeled up to the Teenage Cancer Trust ward at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, which is the most beautiful ward in the world and doesn't feel like a hospital at all. And I was with like other young people and that's when like people started to tell me more about aplastic anemia and what it was and how, you know, like different treatment options. So that was how, sorry, that's a very long way of saying my body was just knackered.
Like I can imagine just that living in the unknown is horrible because you just, you know, you can name something, you can try and at least try to address the issue.
Right.
And I think, yeah, I've spoken to a lot of people that have felt, you know, like extreme fatigue to a degree, you know, especially over the past few years. And usually it's something like maybe like a vitamin deficiency, you know, even that can be hit or miss. So I can imagine like really, yeah, I'm trying to make excuses, trying to find some answer for it.
Yeah, you're just like, I'm not been sleeping. I'm not drinking enough water.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, when you have a horrible headache and you're like, oh, it's because of this. But it's like, can you imagine the headache has just lasted 6 months?
Yeah.
And you're like, I just need a reason. Like, I don't. And then you start thinking, oh my God, this is how I'm going to live for the rest of my life. Like, I'm just going to be tired all the time. I'm just going to be in pain.
What was it like at that moment then when you get that age to kind of process all of this that was happening?
Do you know what? It was funny because I was 17 and the first thing I thought of was, oh my God, I'm going to lose my hair. Which is ridiculous because Actually, I remember the first thing I turned around to my dad, and it was really lucky that I turned to my dad and not the doctor. But I said, like, Dad, am I going to die? And my dad, like, was like, crying at this point as well. And clearly I just knew that, I didn't know what was going on, but I just knew the sheer gravitas. And I was like, whatever's going on is, like, very serious. And it's not just going to be an easy, oh, here's some vitamin D or here's some tablets. Like, whatever's going to happen in the next couple of months or years is going to be hard. But yeah, I was 17 and I was like, I just wanted to travel and go to uni and, like, you know, silly things that are really, when I look back, I'm like, they're not important things. But obviously at that age, you just think, oh, everyone's having their 18th birthday parties and I want to join in. And like, life's just started to pick up now. Like, I'm an adult now. Yeah. And it was just, it was a lot to hear and a lot to think. And I remember the doctor, the consultant, talking a lot about treatment options and whatever. And it was like, do you know one of those film moments when someone's talking but you literally cannot hear the words?
Yeah.
It was just falling on deaf ears, and all, like, my own head was just going, oh my God, you're going to die. You're going to be bald. You're not going to have any like, this is it.
Yeah.
You're not going to go to university. You're not going to, like, be able to travel. You're not never going to be 18. Like, all of this just comes into your head.
Yeah. No, I can imagine at that age, like, I don't, you feel invincible as well. So you don't think, like, typically you don't feel like you could have some major illness. And yeah, like, planning your life, like, going, especially going, planning university is like a huge stage that consumes everything.
That's a big thing.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God, I'm going to be independent. I'm going to do this stuff. And it was at that time that we're applying, you know? So you're like, I'm so excited. And I think we have a really bad habit, just like our society nowadays. We have time frames for everything. I want to be married by the time I'm like this. I want to have babies. I want to be in this job. And that's something that, like, being ill has taught me, is that, you know what, anything can happen at any point. And, like, have a loose plan. Don't have concrete ideas all the time, because, you know, when something goes a little bit awry, which it does, you know, disasters happen, like, random things are constantly going to change. It's okay to be like, oh, I'm going to do this instead.
Yeah.
This is not the end of the world.
No, 100%. I agree with you as well. Like, you can, you just never know what's around the corner. So I've definitely learned that as well over time. Like, short-term plans, and that's it.
Yeah.
And just loose future plans. Yeah.
Plan your dinner tomorrow and then sorted. Exactly. And even that subject has changed. You don't have any tomatoes in the cupboard. Damn it.
And Annie, I was going to ask, obviously, you know, it had a massive impact on your life and everything that you were thinking. Did it change, obviously, you know, receiving the diagnosis, having to get treatment, what was that impact on your studies and what you wanted to do? Did it, how much of your time, you know, was spent in hospital? How did the treatment process go, and what were the long-term effects that it had?
So I was just offered straight away, like, One of the registrar just said to me, like, what would you like to do? Would you like to put your studies on hold for a year? And instantly I just knew that was the right thing. And I think it's because I also just, everything was taking so much energy anyway. I didn't want to also be forcing myself to do work at the same time. And I wasn't doing A-levels, I was doing the IB, which is what you're assessed after 2 years. So I was going to have to then, like, it was just a hefty chunk of work at one stage, and I just knew I wasn't ready for it. And, like, considering I hadn't been into, like, college for the last month or so properly, I was just lagging behind anyway, and I didn't want to think about it. So, yeah, I took a whole year out, and at the start it was fine because I still had loads of friends that were coming to visit me. And honestly, I was in hospital at, so I was having different treatment options, but they were all failing. So in the interim, before I started, this was when they started to think about a stem cell transplant or a bone marrow transplant and finding a match. I was going to hospital 3 times a week for having to have platelet infusions, and once every 2 weeks to have blood transfusions. And then I was in once a week to see a consultant. And sometimes I would have temperatures because my body, like, I didn't have, like, any defense mechanisms. I didn't have any white blood cells. So I was basically spending all my time in hospital. It did become a second home, you know, and the nurses are literally your best friends and they know absolutely everything about you. And I was so fortunate for, like, the proximity of the hospital. I lived in Birmingham and I was being treated at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, which was a 20-minute drive away. My mum took a year off compassionate leave from work, which was great and so helpful. And like, I'm very fortunate to have had the support and care that I have had. But yeah, taking a year out of school at the start was fine, but then when everyone starts moving on, it became really hard. Because not only was I just seeing myself not getting any better, if anything, getting worse, like my body was getting weaker. At one stage before my transplant, I think I weighed like 5.5 stone.
Oh,
like, and I'm not a big girl anyway, yeah. But 5.5, like I looked like a bag of bones and I was barely eating. And then when you lose your hair as well, oh my God, you look so weak. Because it's, especially with somebody like me, I have big curly hair. So it's the thing that I think people look at and they're like, oh, they've got the hair, they're fine. You know, like it's what people associate. As soon you look ill if you have no hair or if you're pale. So, yeah. Also, when I was diagnosed, my blood results were so low. So I don't know how medical you guys or any of the listeners are. But your red blood cell count is meant to be between like 10 and 12. And mine was 4. So that explains how tired I was all the time. My platelet count should have been between 100 to 150. Some people have like loads, like 400, but I had, I think it was 2. So if I'd bled at all, like I wouldn't have been able to stop it. That's why they kept giving me like scans for bleeding on the brain, etc. And then my white cell count, no, it was my neutrophil count, was something like 0.8, and it should have been 3 to something else. So I was literally on death's door and like not knowing how I was surviving at this stage. And that was just getting worse and worse because I had like none of the treatment options were working for me. So I was just seeing everyone going off and like going to university and planning all their like, you know, their end of year 11 holidays and not end of year 11, end of like sixth form holidays and like, you know, all the like girls trip stuff. And I'm there just like stuck in hospital, looking rubbish, feeling rubbish and just like feeling really lonely. So yeah, I think I found towards the end, the mental strain part of it was so much worse than anything else.
Yeah. I mean, Annie, you mentioned there were a number of different treatment options that were, you know, you had to go through to be able to see. How many were that? Because you said there were a number of them that failed and you had to keep trying.
So it was a lot of, I had this thing called ATG, like antibody therapy, that was actually from a rabbit. No, it was a horse first. That failed, but it was a lot of monitoring and it was a lot of like 2 months, maybe it'll get better. And you know, when you have all this false hope, and that's what we struggled with the most, that my parents were like, oh, this is it, this is the solution, you'll be fine. Because we just didn't want, there were like talks at the start of a stem cell transplant being the best cure. And I kind of just knew the risks associated with it in the first place, because I'd had, there were people in our family that have sadly passed away from a bone marrow transplant. Just not going well. And I just knew how, like, I had Google, I was researching it. I knew they weren't easy things. So yeah, we were doing antibody therapies and they weren't working. And then I was just basically clinging to anything, having transfusions all the time. My brother and sister were tested to see if they were matches, if there would be matches, and both of them weren't. My sister at that time also was like 5 years old, so I think part of us, we were a bit relieved because we were like, whoa, how on earth would she have done this? But yeah, I remember that phone call, actually. I remember getting a phone call and it was from the consultant and it was up. And I remember, like, I think we were playing, like, Cluedo or some random board game just in the kitchen. And he, like, called me and he was like, hi, is this Anissa? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, hi, it's the doctor from the haematologist. And I was like, oh, my God. And I think mum, like, paused the music. And it just started off as, I'm really sorry, but we found out that your siblings aren't a match. And I just remember my, like, heart just sinking and being like, is there ever going to be something that's going to make me better?
Yeah,
because it just feels like, you know, when you're in something like COVID felt, when you're in lockdown, it felt like it'd gone on for like 500 years. So this was like the same thing. It just felt like I was, nothing was getting better and it was taking so long. Looking back, a year, 2 years is not a long time, but when you're in it, it feels like, oh my God, yeah. There is no silver lining. There is no solution and we're never going to get there.
Yeah, I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Do you have, do you get like mental health counselling like during that process?
Yeah, I was quite late with it because I'm not the best at talking about things, which is something that I've now learned to do. But I definitely bottled stuff up a lot. And I was like, no, it's fine. Everything's going to be fine. You know, you just like try and be optimistic. So when things were really not going well, and like my self-confidence, like my body, my self-esteem just like dropped, and I was like, I hated how I looked. So I had things over the mirrors. Like, I just didn't want to look at myself, and I didn't want to like touch anything. I didn't want people to see me. I didn't want to like, I smelt weird, you know, like I probably didn't, but I was like, I can smell medicine on me all the time. I looked weird. I was like, acting strange. So yeah, I had, thankfully towards the end, I was talking to a psychologist who was really great, and it really did help to talk to somebody. And I did have some of my friends who are still like my best friends now. Like, there was this one time when I was in my transplant, and I never responded to somebody for a few days, like my friend Emma, and she just showed up the next day with the smelliest food ever. It was like chicken and chips and loads of mayo, and I'm a vegetarian, and I was like, that's disgusting. And she just showed up, and she was like, you don't have to talk to me, I just wanted to make sure you're okay, you can go back to sleep. And she just sat in the corner of the room whilst I slept, and I was like, I remember at the time being like, oh, but also waking up to being like, I'm so glad Emma's here. Like, you know, it's so nice to have those friends.
Yeah.
Who don't need you to sit up and talk, or who don't, or who, if you don't respond to a message, it's like, oh, they'll be fine. You know, it's a bit of both. It was like, you know what, you haven't responded for 3 days, I'm just going to see you. You don't have to talk to me, it's fine.
No, that sounds like an incredible friend. That's the kind of relationships you need to have in your life.
Yeah, like Katie and Anna, like all these people, like we used to order Domino's to the hospital sometimes, and people would sleep over. Like, I was really quite fortunate. And it's times like this that really shows you who your best friends and who is really important. Yeah. Like my nan and granddad and my grandparents and like all the family were constantly around. But yeah.
I mean, I was going to say, it sounds like from everything you've said, you did have an incredible support network, both through your family and your friends. I mean, I was going to ask, in terms of like, and your siblings as well, I mean, obviously it had a massive impact on you and you're the person going through it. But what would you also say is like the impact that those closest to you, your loved ones, also had to face because of what was happening?
You know, it's such a weird one, because obviously when you're in it, people aren't talking to you like, I feel sad about you. So you kind of just think, oh, everyone's doing all right, even though, you know, like I would see my mum's eye bags, like she's clearly been crying. My dad is not, like, they're constantly saying, oh, we'll think of something, you know, and a lot of it was happening behind the scenes, which I think I'm a little bit grateful for, because then I wasn't also worrying about them as much. Mm-hmm. But it was, I think Emma actually mentioned it. She was like, we did have to have conversations that was like, what if she dies? And it was crazy, because I didn't know that they were having these conversations, because when I was seeing them, they were like, we're here for you, you know, like, we'll think about this and that. And I didn't realise that these were the conversations that were happening around me. And it's really tough, I guess, for my family as well. I guess my dad had just started a new job the first day. The day that I was diagnosed was the day that he had handed in his resignation for his previous job. Like, it was spooky. The night before, he'd handed in his resignation and then just decided to accept a job that was closer to home. Literally the next day I was diagnosed. It probably destiny. Someone out there in the stars did align to make that happen. But it's hard, like, juggling all of this and then, yeah, trying to look after two kids as well. So I guess my brother was in doing his like A-levels, and my sister was really young, like in between like nursery and school. And like, I don't know how, like, some families just don't have the support networks that are going to offer to take the kid to school or look after somebody or help with parking. Or I had, like, my aunt, I started to like really weird tasting foods, like really strong tasting foods. Chemo makes your taste buds a bit weird. So I just fell in love with mustard, and my aunt was there like experimenting and making me like fish pie that was just like drenched in like mustard and like really strong like flavors. I love Nutella and like chocolate, and I realized the only way that I could eat Ferrero Rocher without it tasting like metal, which is what chemo tastes like, would be like, I think I'd have to have a shot of like lemon juice, and then I'd have like a bit of salt, and then I could finally, if I just quickly put a Ferrero Rocher in my mouth at that point, I could taste it and it wouldn't taste horrible. It was so weird.
Yeah, it sounds like doing some sort of shot, like, to make it.
Yeah, honestly, it was like, this is the only way I could taste it.
For a moment, I thought you were going to say you had to put mustard on your chocolate.
I know, I never tried it, actually. Maybe I should have done. Damn it, that would have been, it was such a hassle squeezing lemon into my mouth. Oh, where were you?
Something you can, like, yeah, it would be interesting to know what that tastes like. But yeah, so I just say something, yeah. You know, you're talking about your, you know, family. So how did you continue, like, that search for a donor?
So what happened was, after treatment was just not working, we had a formal, like, sit down appointment with a consultant who said, this is the only option. We're going to have to get a stem cell or bone marrow transplant. And it was one of those appointments where, you know, you're just being greeted by statistics and they tell you all the risks. And basically it seems like, what's the point? And you're 17 years old and you're hearing, oh yeah, you could be infertile. Oh yeah, your hair might not grow back. Oh, actually, you might be weak forever. Your immune system may not improve. You're going to be locked up for like a year or something. There are so many complications. You could have problems with your lungs. You could have this. The actual illness that you're trying to treat might not go away. And you just kind of think, oh my God, why am I doing this? Like, it sounds horrific. And then they're like, oh, by the way, chemo actually causes more cancers. It also has loads of other side effects. You're going to be puking. You're going to be, and you just think, what is it? Like, is anything worth that? But, I mean, I kind of had to push that to the side because at that point I was like, I don't even know if I'm going to find a match. So what happened was there was a UK-wide search and we were like, okay, fine. They'll come back to us in like 2-3 weeks. But we didn't think that I wouldn't find a match. Like, at this stage we were like, people find them all the time. And it was coming up to 3 weeks to 4 weeks and there was nothing. And the doctors were like, we're going to look worldwide. We were like, okay, fine, great. And it was 1 week of waiting, which turned into 2 weeks of waiting, which turned into like 2 months of waiting, and there was nothing. And you just think, oh my God, I'm one person in the whole world on all these registers. There's no one who's a close enough match that can save me. And I remember being, because we were in a bay, and my friend, I don't know if I probably won't mention her name, she was a white girl. And she had leukemia, and she was also due a stem cell transplant. And she had found 4 really good 10 out of 10 matches from the UK register alone after searching for only 1 week. And I couldn't find one after searching for 3 months on the worldwide register. I wasn't even looking for a 10 out of 10. They were like, we're settling for a 7 out of 10. There was nothing.
Yeah, and that's simply because there aren't enough people from an ethnic minority background on these registers.
Yeah, right. And it's horrible because you think, well, am I being punished for being Asian? Like, is it hard enough being an ethnic minority because there's not enough to, like what we were saying before, there aren't enough people out there that we can look at as role models. But here I am ill and, like, I'm being treated at the on an NHS hospital. We're all the same here. We're all just, like, fighting for our lives, but how, like, is my life not worth as much as somebody else's? And it makes you feel like you're just being completely let down by your community, because I was told that the best matches come from the same ethnicity, so the same ethnic background. So I'm just there waiting for somebody who thinks my life's worth it to sign up. And it's horrible. Because you honestly feel like you're just being let down by these people, which you haven't. I think not enough people know anything about it, which was hard. But it was just one of those things where I was like, how can I be this unfortunate? And like the waiting, like a waiting game is hard anyway. I'm sure you've all had to wait for things in your life. It's horrible, isn't it? Like, you're waiting for results. You're like, nothing can happen. But this was just like, I'm waiting for a cure right now, and all I'm doing is getting weaker. And I'm relying on a community that half, like, loads of people don't think it's the right thing or don't know enough about it and don't understand. And I don't know how I'm meant to fix this, being an 18-year-old stuck in hospital, bold, weak, and just afraid.
It's mind-blowing when you think about how diverse as well the UK is. And, you know, we both grew up in London around, like, really diverse communities too. So I would never have guessed that really, like, it would be so difficult to find a match, you know, when you really need it.
For sure. It's so hard. Like, there's some of the statistics are really quite staggering. I think it's patients who are, like, white Northern European have a 72% chance of finding the best match from an unrelated donor. But that drops to just 37% chance for patients from ethnic minority backgrounds. And that's literally everyone non-white. That's so many people that are literally just getting half a chance to find a good match. And a good match means a good result. And if you don't have a high match, like, sometimes it's not worth having a transplant because you're not going to live, like, you're not going to survive. That's the black and white of it. So we need good matches. So we need people to sign up. And, like, I'm not a scientist, but I can tell you that people are still being diagnosed with blood cancers and blood diseases. And it doesn't discriminate, you know, like, it could be your aunt, your uncle, your brother, your sister, your grandma, your granddad, like, and it's affecting all ages, all races, all ethnicities, all classes, you know, like, it's everyone.
Yeah, so I used to work in a scientific lab. I did cancer research, and I'm still working in the same field. Wow, and even though there are so many advances just generally in the world of, you know, like, technology, space, and medicine too, there are so many, new treatments and drug treatments that are coming out all the time. And there's been, you know, huge advances made with better treatments. But at the end of the day, we don't have anything for a lot of different diseases, especially like advanced cancers, that can cure you. There is still so many patients who are diagnosed at such a late stage, and they have, you know, like a less than 10% chance of survival, depending on what cancers that they have. So there's huge advances that are still needed. We're nowhere near perfect. And that's why we have to rely on things like transplants and finding those matches. Like, even I think, I don't know where, like, the transplant stage is at in terms of research and development, but we still have to rely on other humans to, you know, provide healthy cells for others who don't have enough healthy cells yet.
We're literally relying on a stranger to save your life.
Exactly. And I think most people don't think about it until they're in that situation, until they know someone who turns sick, and then they'll, you know, fight like how to, you know, obviously for them now, they know that person, and they obviously want their lives to be safe. They don't want to lose that person and do everything they can to try and find them a match. But I think, we need to be more proactive, you know, in so many areas of our community to try and, you know, let's not let it get to that stage. Like, if you are, you know, there's certain criteria I know around, you know, donating stem cells. But for anyone out there listening, it's like typically in that demographic as well. So definitely, you know, we'll provide all the links and things to the information around stem cell transplantation. But it's definitely, you know, it takes 2 minutes to take a look, you know, at that information, because you could be eligible and, you know, you might be asked to donate, you might never be asked to donate, but it could save someone's life. And to our listeners, if you're interested in learning more about the register, you can visit anthonynolan.org/British Muslim Girl Diaries. There's also a link in our episode description.
I just had a question that I thought maybe actually both of you might know the answer to, because I'm also assuming it's not just about getting a match as well, that there's probably a high threshold in order to be able to get a match, right, in terms of, you know, the compatibility and so on. So maybe just that also makes it even more challenging to be able to find a donor, which is why I guess we need more people to be able to register and be on these lists.
So to find a stem cell match, they look at your HLA type, which I guess in my head I was like, oh, you just need the same blood type. And actually it's like different components of your blood. And Zara, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know how much I know, but they use out of 10 scale for a lot of the stem cell transplants. Just, I don't know if that's just to simplify it for other people who don't really know, but a 10 out of 10 match is like ideal in terms of the components. And then they won't really go anything below 6 out of 10. Your parents are a 5 out of 10 match, and so 7 and above is like, all right, pretty good.
Yeah. I think the idea is to just try and get, you know, so your stem cells need to be like the best genetic match as possible to the person receiving the transplant, because, you know, your own immune system, if it's not such a close match, it will recognize it as like a foreign invader in your body. And your purpose of your immune system is to attack and get rid of anything that's typically like not meant to be there. So then your own immune system can typically reject that match. So you want to get as close as possible. And then I guess in this case, typically, you know, someone from a similar, you know, genetic background. So like you go to your family first, but if they're not a match, then you really need to turn to people who might be from a similar genetic makeup. So someone who's from a similar, you know, ethnic background. And then that's where we kind of as a community run into that problem. And again, it's shocking as well, like worldwide though, that was, you know, an issue. I didn't know that. So it's definitely something we need to talk more about and, you know, be proactive about, like, even if we're not in the right, you know, either age range or health status, we might know people that are actually, so we can always.
Yeah, it's all about sharing, you know?
Yeah.
Completely. It's all about like sharing and just talking about it. And I knew so many people that I would like mention, oh, this is what it's about. And so many people were like, oh, I'll sign up instantly. And I was like, oh, this is what the process is like. They were like, that's cool, I'll do it. And it was like, if I hadn't had that conversation, that would be one less person that would be on that register. And that one person could actually be a match for somebody. And it is incredible how many people don't know about it and like just want to know a little bit more and need to like dig in a little bit. But one thing I do say, which is really important, I had one of my friends had a match that was like quite a close match, but unfortunately the person decided that they didn't want to go ahead and donate because of whatever reason, maybe it was like fear of needles or whatever. And my friend who had that match and all her family had preparations for this transplant to go ahead. So to take that away from people is worse than signing up, than like not signing up. And if you can't for any reason, then that's fine. Yeah. But like, let's share it, let's talk about it. Yeah,
I definitely think, and people don't know much about the process.
For sure. So 90%, there are about 850,000 people on the Anthony Nolan Stem Cell Register, and 90% of donors donate through, it's like peripheral blood stem cell, yeah, I'm saying that right, PBSC donation, which is essentially like you're being stuck. So this is how my dad donated to me. So my dad was a match, well, not a match, but basically, I'm doing this in such a weird order, sorry. So when I was in hospital and we couldn't find a match that was good enough, it was basically like nothing, or we go ahead with a really risky transplant from your dad. And you'd think, oh, well, that's easy. Honestly, it wasn't. The risks that were associated with it and the statistics, when you think I'm going to go ahead with somebody who's 6 out of 10, when you wouldn't even take someone who's 7, like that's a big deal.
So your dad was only like a partial match?
Yeah. I was lucky that he was more than 50%. So he was a all right match. So he went ahead and did it. So he donated through the peripheral blood method. He had injections, I think, 4 days beforehand just to like stimulate your stem cells. And I think he didn't really get any side effects or anything. He felt a bit tired. But when he donated, like, honestly, the worst part about donating was that he was stuck in a room on a chair and had to listen to my mum moan at him for 5 hours. He was like, that's the hardest part, was that he was just like, great, I'll have a telly. And it's essentially like, I don't know if any of you have ever given blood or anyone listening has ever given blood, but you put one needle goes in one arm and then there's like some machine that takes all the stem cells, all the stuff that we're trying to collect from it. And then another needle goes in the other arm and it collects. It like filters out. It gives you all the blood products that are not your stem cells back into your body. So you haven't lost anything that's not your stem cells. Don't know if that makes sense. But it feels like you're just giving blood.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of it as well. Yeah, it looks like it too. It looks like when you just donate blood or if you have to go for a blood test and they remove blood from your arm.
Yeah, it's essentially like that for a long time.
Yeah.
But like my dad went to mow the lawn at my granddad's the next day. And I know somebody who also donated and then he played football the next day. Like it does depend. Some people bounce back. Some people just feel really tired and a bit flu-y for a few days.
Mm-hmm. And is it a one-off donation? Or did he have to just do that procedure once? It wasn't a repeated?
Yeah, so
yeah.
He just did that one. But you will find out if you've collected enough cells after that first donation. So most of the cases you have, But you might need to do another set of injections and do it again if not. But also 10% of donors donate through the bone marrow, which is, I think, the thing people are always a bit nervous about because it sounds very grueling. And my aunt actually donated this way for her younger son, and it just felt like she slipped on ice. That's how she describes it. But you were put under general anaesthetic and they extract some bone marrow fluid from the back of your hip, the side of your hip. But you stay in hospital for a night. Auntie Nolan put you up in a nice hotel, I think, and then they come and visit you. But yeah, that's the one that makes you feel like you've like had a bad fall, I think a lot of people have said.
And I think you're completely right as well that awareness raising is needed because there's so much information that people don't have. I mean, to me, I would have thought, you know, a family member, there's like a high chance or high likelihood that they would be like the most suitable match, but the fact that there's still a lot of risk involved and it's taking a chance and seeing if that works is, yeah, that's, I don't think that's something a lot of people are aware of.
For me as well, like I was offered that because I was like a rare case. Most people won't be offered that, and my dad was a 6 out of 10 match, whereas most parents will be a 5 out of 10 match. He always says, oh, you've got super stem cells now. And I'm like, but I've also now got hay fever. So annoying. And I'm eaten to death by midges every year. And it's because I've got my dad's blood. Damn it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I was very fortunate for that. But yeah, I think people just assume, oh, like with kidney. I think with kidney donations, like, I don't know enough. I'm not going to start talking about kidneys. I don't know anything. but yeah, it's not as simple as, oh, you can find someone with the same blood type or someone in your family. Like, you won't necessarily have that option.
And you've mentioned the Anthony Nolan charity, which does, you know, operate the stem cell register. Can anyone join, though? Are there any restrictions, anything that would prevent someone from joining that people need to know about?
Yeah, so whilst there's no risk to the person donating, there is, and you can see if you go online on the website, there is a lot of information about people who can sign up. So for example, if you have had cancer in the past or you receive regular blood transfusions or you have sickle cell anemia, there's a load of things. So if you have eczema, for example, you can donate. If you have this problem, you maybe can't. So there's a lot of information about whether or not you can or can't donate. The Anthony Nolan Register is for people who are over. It's for people, you must be 16 to 30 to donate. But you need to be like a healthy weight, basically. And it's just because you need to be healthy in order to donate.
Yeah. No, we'll definitely direct people to, we have links to the website that has a great list of FAQs as well that can answer, you know, any questions about being eligible and then signing up and then what that process is like to register and then also what that donation process is like, as you've described as well. So there's a lot of great information online about that. So I just want to ask, did you contact the charity as well to find out, or is that all just done through the NHS?
I don't know if that was my consultant, but I just remember one day when I was in a haematology clinic, I was greeted by this woman who was lovely, and she worked closely with Auntie Nolan, and they were like, we need to help you because it's ridiculous that you don't have a match. So we started a bit of a UK-wide, like nationwide campaign, and I did a few videos, you can see them on YouTube, which was all about just trying to like raise awareness for ethnic minorities. And it was just basically because all their data was lining up, like it was saying that it's so difficult for somebody who's non-white to find a match, and there I was living this truth. And they were like, yeah, we need to try and get it out there, we need people to know, and we need to try and get people to sign up. There's about 2,300 people in the UK need a stem cell transplant from a stranger every year, which is quite crazy because that doesn't account for all the other people who need a stem cell transplant but get it from a sibling or a parent, you know. So many people, and like blood cancer and blood is like the fifth most common type of cancer in the UK, and it's the third biggest killer. So like these statistics, unfortunately, they're not diminishing. So that's why I'm working with Auntie Nolan to raise awareness, and that's why it's so important that we raise this awareness and we try and spread this message to as many people as possible. And it's also really straightforward, you know, there's like nothing worse than 12,000 forms. Like, you can click a link, you type in some information, you then get sent like a swab, and you literally Like, we've been doing COVID tests for how long? This is even easier. You literally swab the back of your mouth, you put it in a little envelope, and then you send it off free, and then you're signed up.
Which is I was thinking that everyone's swab ready now. We already know, like, we've had to deal with all these various COVID tests, either like sticking it up your nose or the back of your throat. Like, I've had some crazy ones.
Yeah.
This is even easier.
Yeah. Just make sure you haven't had a take beforehand, because I was working at the university stand and this woman was like, oh yeah, I'd like to do my swab or do my, it was spit in the tube at the time. Hmm. And I was like, okay, great. I was like, have you eaten anything in the last hour? She was like, no, she clearly forgot. And she spat, and I was like, don't we have to do that again? Because there was literally bits, chunks of chocolate cake just floating in there. Unless you're donating to somebody who's like 90% chocolate cake, I don't think you're going to be a match for anyone.
Oh my god, that would be hilarious. A bit traumatizing to have witnessed that.
It was worth it. It was a delicious cake, apparently. So there we go.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool that you could just donate that. Like, if you see a stand then for Anthony Nolan, and then you could actually donate. Like, I mean, sign up. I mean, yeah, with the doing that swab, actually, it shows you how easy it is. So
yeah. So Anthony Nolan ran a few recruitment drives. That's what we call them. And I've worked with some. And like when I was diagnosed, my dad did a few in like mosques, because it's just helpful to have like an imam stand there and say, you know what, like, to save one life is to save 1,000. I think there's like quotes, and there's so many things where it's not harming you. So if you can help people, why would you not? Like, where on earth does this not agree with anything in any religion?
You know? Yeah, like, I was actually going to mention, exactly, I think some people maybe in the community aren't sure about like whether you can donate or not. So I actually looked this up online on a couple of Islamic websites beforehand, and actually the general consensus is that there, you know, is no ruling against donating stem cells to another person, no matter, you know, what, who they are, no matter what background they're from, because like you said, at the end of the day, you're saving a life, and there's a minimal risk to your own health here.
Yeah.
And there is a verse in the Quran that most people know about that says, you know, whoever saves a life, it's as though he has saved the lives of all mankind. So, and I think it speaks to that. So, you know, there's nothing larger than that. So I think it's part of our duty as well to do what we can.
So I think we have a problem with a lot of things when there's, when issues arise, we're like, we're so helpless, like there's nothing we can do about it. Like you hear about all these crises and you're like, I really want to help. Like, there's only so much I can donate monetary wise. Like, can I let this person, can I, you know, take in a refugee? Can I do this? Can I, sometimes there are just things that are just out of our control. Whereas this, like, we have a potential solution. Like, you can sign up. So if, you know, if the opportunity is there and if there is a solution and there is a way to help, why would we not take it? And it is straightforward and it is free. And it's quick, and like you can find out all the information online, you know? And the risk to the donor is usually only if you take the, if you donate through the bone marrow, it's the same risks that are associated with general anaesthetic.
Yeah. Well, weirdly, I was going to add, I was just going to say, this just popped into my head actually, this week I was reading, it was about this article about Nancy Reagan, very random. But she was against stem cell research for a really long time until her husband needed it, and then actually tried to push through like legislation through like US like Senate and Congress. So again, it's that thing where I think a lot of people are apprehensive, but when you think of your loved one, your friend, your family member, and you want to save their life, I think ultimately no one would really ever refuse to like to donate or do something about this. So I think it's just, it's just something for everyone to think about. It can happen to anyone that you, you know, you love and you're close to. And it's, from the sounds of everything you said as well, a simple procedure, and we all know how to do swabs now. We have no excuses.
And I was just going to ask, from like, I guess that the faith perspective, like what was the support or the reaction like from the like Muslim community then when you approached them? Or
it was largely good, but I think it's because I'm also in a very fortunate position, whereas my granddad has has been chair of mosques and like treasurers, and is like a strong pillar in the community, that he was able to talk to a lot of the, you know, it tends to be the older generation that are a bit more apprehensive. And I think what we found was our biggest barrier was, you know, when like Asians in general, we're not very big. So I think when, like, we had one girl who was like, I just really want to sign up, but like my dad won't let me. Because I think there's this thing where there's this paternal and very like masculine instinct where it's like, we need to protect our poor girls. They look so young. They look so fragile. So I think this was a lot of the like, and it's definitely a culture problem rather than a religious problem. But that's what I think was like one of the biggest barriers. And like, for example, my brother is, 26 now? Yes. Just turned 26. Oh, yesterday, actually. And he's been trying to be on the register, but he's still underweight. So obviously there is a problem with just like size-wise and health-wise. But I think sometimes you just need to hear it from an imam or somebody in the community that you trust or that you know. Because there's so much information out there. And if you want to Google anything, you'll find whatever answer you're looking for. If you want to Google to find out that it's wrong, you will be able to find that. If you want to Google to find out that it's right, you will find that too. So I think people sometimes just need to have someone to look at to say, oh, okay, this is right, we can go ahead and do it. But yeah, we did have a few drives in mosques, and just at my granddad's house, which is in Small Heath in Birmingham, which has a big large Asian community. But yeah, not as successful as we'd have hoped, and I'm not quite sure what that barrier is, which is a shame. We're still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, I wonder if it's just the potential risk. I think people, if you don't know enough about it, they're thinking, because it sounds like it could be a big medical procedure.
Well, but that the word bone marrow, which is why I don't use it, sounds like someone's hacking someone's bones. Like, it sounds like, yeah. Oh my God, what is this? And stem cell, nobody knows what they are, so that sounds fine.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, there's not enough, like, I think, and if you don't run in circles where you've heard about this before, if you're not on like social media, if you don't listen to like podcasts and things, then everything sounds so alien and like, oh no,
yeah,
what's this? So, but I feel like, you know, especially in our generation now, people can easily, you know, find out this information. We, you know, are on social media more and we can get out there and help. Sure. So I think, yeah, it's really important to keep passing on that message.
It's a shame as well, because for some reason, young men are the most likely to be chosen to donate, but they only make up 18% of the register. But they make up over half of donations in the UK. So if we can spread it to our young men out there, that would be great, because like, they're such good donors for whatever reason that is. Maybe, I don't know, build or just the way genetics works. But it's a shame that they make up less than 20%. Like, that's less than a fifth of the register, but they are such good donors.
I didn't know that actually before. So I think that's it. And we just have to pass on that message. Like, you've got to think about any people from ethnic backgrounds that you know, anyone who's male as well. Brown boys, do your part.
There you go, where are you at?
I have no idea where they are. But yeah, actually, and I just wanted to ask you, like, in general, reflecting on, you know, what all this that you've been through, like the physical and then emotional stress of it all, like, what do you feel like you've learned about, I guess, yourself or just life in general?
So much. I think I was a crazy perfectionist before I was diagnosed. I still, to a certain extent, am still cry over the fact that I can't do cartwheels, but I was a stickler for, I want to be absolutely perfect at absolutely everything. And when this hit me like a bus and I realized that I didn't have to be and I couldn't, you know, it just made me think, like I was talking about having time restrictions, you know, life is constantly changing and you can never be prepared for everything. But it's all about being flexible and just appreciating what actually is important. So family and friends and having this network. I am so unbelievably grateful for the NHS and for Auntie Nolan and for Teenage Cancer Trust, because I don't know what it would have been without them. like those 2 years were horrific. Like my family, but I had a social worker that like chatted to me and chatted to my friends, chatted to my mum. I had like, and you know, I made friends on the ward, which were great because nobody else in the world knows what you're going through apart from other people in that situation. And it sucked because a lot of those friends I've sadly lost. And that's through the fact that they haven't found matches or their transplants didn't go well or whatever their treatment was for whatever reason. Maybe they were too late. There were loads of different cancers, loads of different illnesses in the same ward. But it just makes you appreciate what actually really is important. And, you know, everyone suffers. Everyone has their, like, I feel really preachy, but everyone has their, like, big obstacles that come in their way. And it's all about, I guess, how you deal with them. And yeah, the fact that I had such an incredible support network just makes me really fortunate and makes me just shout out to all those people out there who are going through illnesses, cancers, whatever they're going through. I just hope that people out there have that same network or have people to rely on, because people are honestly, people are annoying and rude and irritating sometimes, but also they make the worst situations in the world, like, bearable.
I guess I'm also just curious, maybe, like, what's next for you? I mean, you said that there are a lot of things you wanted to do. Anything in the pipeline? Do you, yeah, what's coming up? What's next in your life?
So I live in London because I was so lucky to get a job working at the National Theatre. So that's where I'm working now. And I absolutely love it. I'm a production assistant and my contract ends the end of October. Yeah, it's like,
well,
Halloween.
That
week.
Very spooky.
I'm not quite sure. I kind of just want to travel. Like, there's so much world to see. Maybe do some teaching. Like, I don't know, just explore so much out there. Like, I want to go scuba diving. I want to, like, do some cooking lessons. I just want to do absolutely everything and anything that comes my way. But yeah, I'm just being flexible and figuring it all out. But also short term, yeah, I'm thinking about a Nutella ice cream this afternoon.
And just to flag, we're not sponsored by Nutella.
Yeah.
I'm actually addicted. It's quite bad. That was the moment that I realised I was well again. Other chocolate hazelnut spread options are available.
Yeah, this is not a sponsored. But yeah, and I'm going to try that naan and chocolate, I mean, naan and Nutella thing one day. That's
I'll do it. I mean, it's fresh bread, like nothing beats naan, and then nothing beats Nutella, do it.
But yeah, again, I just want to say thank you so much for coming to talk to us today. I think it's so good to like listen to stories like yours because they're really inspiring, but they give a lot of perspective on our own lives too. And like you said, I think it was a good point around, we always, when we see things happening abroad, we always wish we could do something to help.
Do something.
But this is something like tangible and we can physically actually do something.
No, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Exactly, yeah. So thanks for that.
You're welcome. As you can tell, I can talk for England. So I hope your listeners are not bored by my massive stories. But yeah, thank you.
Thanks to everyone for tuning in. If you're between 16 and 30 and in relatively good health, you're eligible to join the Anthony Nolan Register. To join the Stem Cell Register, you need to fill in their online form to request a swab pack. Once you get the pack, you swab the inside of your cheek for a few seconds and post it back. And once your swab is returned back to Anthony Nolan, you are officially on the Stem Cell Register. The average person has a 1 in 800 chance of being asked to donate. If you're interested in learning more about the register or you know others who might be eligible, please visit anthonynolan.org/British Muslim Girl Diaries. There's more information on the website about what's involved in the registration process and the two ways in which you can potentially donate your stem cells if you turn out to be a match for someone. We've posted a link into our episode description. Again, ethnic minorities are seriously underrepresented on these registers, and imagine if you or your parents, siblings, or closest friends were in need of a life-saving transplant. You would do everything you could to help find a match. Please visit the website link in the description and at least read what is involved in the process. You could be saving someone's life. Thank you, and see you next time.